Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Our guest today is Paul Theroux, who to most of you needs no introduction. He's a renowned novelist, short story writer, and perhaps is most well-known as a travel writer, whose The Great Railway Bazaar back in 1975 was a seminal work that influenced pretty much every travel writer since. He's written over 30 novels and short story collections, many adapted for the screen, and about 20 nonfiction works mostly devoted to travel, with the last being his Deep South in 2015, documenting his travels through the southern states of this country. Today we'll be discussing with him Motherland, published just last week by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. There are two ways that one could begin a discussion of Motherland. You could be a casual reader who happens into my bookstore, sees the book on the front table exhibited prominently and falls in love with the cover, and it's a striking one, not knowing who Paul Theroux is or just vaguely recognizing the name, picks up the hefty, over 500-page book, and decides after reading the blurbs and jacket that the story of a large, dysfunctional family over a series of decades narrated by what may be a slightly unreliable brother is just what suits his fancy on that day. Or you could come into the bookstore knowing lots about Paul Theroux, how the number and members of his family almost exactly mirror the number and members of the family in Motherland, including his 103-year-old mother, how Paul wrote two stories that appeared in The New Yorker, the first, The Best Year of My Life in 2005, and the second, Upside Down Cake in 2016, set 30 years apart, both of which stories find their way into Motherland. You might know that Paul is father to British authors and filmmakers Marcel and Lewis, and is the brother of authors Alexander and Peter, and uncle of the American actor and screenwriter Justin Theroux, married to Jennifer Aniston. You would also know that Paul, decades ago, wrote a story and also a kind of autobiography novel, My Other Life, that his then-wife took umbrage to and wrote a letter to The New Yorker objecting to certain aspects of the story. And Paul's brother, Alexander, wrote a scathing review of My Other Life, which finds its way sometimes verbatim into Motherland, so scathing that it's sometimes held up as an example of the nastiest of all brother-brother diatribes. Motherland contains all of Paul's family, except you can't really be sure if that's the case or not. For someone who's followed his career, it's kind of confusing. As Paul's Wikipedia entry states, by including versions of himself, his family, and acquaintances in some of his fiction, Theroux has occasionally disconcerted his readers. Well, he certainly has this one. As Paul himself has said in the past, he thinks of his fiction as my life with liberties. Bottom line is, it's a fascinating, hilarious, mean-spirited book that keeps you on your toes, intimately involved with the characters, and unfortunately, if you have to get up early in the morning like I do, almost requires that you read it in one sitting, which I did, to my dismay. So with that, welcome, Paul, and thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Sam. Nice to talk to you.
So, is this your life with liberties?
Well, all fiction is sort of like, as far as all good fiction is, life with taking liberties. But this is a book I've been working on for a long time. I mean, more than 10 years. You say the stories in The New Yorker, actually those are chapters from the book. They were always chapters rather than stories, but they're sort of freestanding chapters. And I was writing this with my left hand when I was writing everything else, you know, books about Africa and even other novels. So I refer to it sort of as my David Copperfield. You know, when Charles Dickens was going to write his autobiography, he started and he thought, I don't know whether he said, oh, heck, but sort of an oh, heck moment. I'm not going to write my autobiography. I'm going to write a novel based on my life, and he wrote David Copperfield. So I think of this as like that, which is overlapping my life, of course, but with a lot of liberty. Fiction. It really is a novel with elements of my life in it, as any autobiographical novel would be.
But the fascinating thing is that you have, do you simply see things the way they are, or do you paint them as you wish them to be, or as you wish the reader to see them? Because the family is, as in one interview someone asked you, they said, you have a heavy, balding, basically unattractive family in this book. They're cruel to each other, to their aged mother. They're full of themselves. They're full of resentment. And that's true in the book. But do I want it to be true of your family? No. But are you telling me that it is true of your family? It is confusing to a reader in a very fascinating way.
I think it's better not to think about my family and only to think about the novel. You know, in a sense, this is a novel about a man who becomes a writer. And explains how it was that he became a writer. That is a subject, you know, the writing life doesn't interest me a lot. People will say, oh, writing's so difficult, and looking at a blank page, and finding an agent, finding a publisher. That stuff really doesn't interest me at all. What interests me is what gets into a person, what is the motivating factor, the weevil in a biscuit, that makes a person become a writer? And the circumstances of a family, particularly this family, and the mother, contribute to a very, very large degree of the narrator becoming a writer. It's not me. I'm a fairly well-to-do, happy writer. I've published virtually everything I've ever written. I've had a very well-rewarded career, and the circumstances of my life are salubrious and pleasant. The guy in the book regards himself as a failure. He says, how is it that at the end of my life I'm living in a rental house near my family, behaving like a child among my contentious, rancorous siblings? And so he's having a very tough time. I'm not, obviously. So I think best not to think about my family, but to think about the family in the book. But the family in the book actually creates the circumstances for this guy becoming a writer. And toward the end of the book, he realized, the guy, Jay, not me, but realizes that it's difficult as his mother was. In fact, she was a tyrant. She created these circumstances for him to become a writer. He was rebelling against her, and she's his muse. Who is it? One of the brothers says, who is she? The narrator says, she was my muse. She was the reason I became a writer.
Yeah, it's clear that because of the circumstances of his upbringing, that's what pushed him, maybe not voluntarily and maybe not in the way he would have liked to have been pushed, but pushed him into becoming a writer. That's perfectly clear. And I won't belabor the point about trying to conflate you and Jay, but then if that's the case, as a reader, you kind of have to give me a break. If you include Floyd's review of your book and you actually use the real words he used in the review, I have to do something with that because I am reading the book and I do know the review. And I know the review and the chapter in the book are the same words. So you've got to give me something to say, okay, this is a joke, or my brother and I get along great and this is just my way of, you know, playing with the reader. It's got to be something, because you did it.
I get along fairly well with my brother. Did write that review. That's a verbatim review of my book, My Other Life, and it's an amazing piece of work.
It is.
Absolutely, when you realize that's one brother reviewing another brother's book, and it's not just a scathing review. It's a destructive, toxic. You can't imagine a worse review. It's the worst review I have ever received in my life. But also, it's too good to waste. I guess, you know, I've, it, but it was amazing. But it didn't really hurt me. It didn't hurt the book. It was so astonishingly rancorous, so amazingly wicked and cruel. That, you know, it's like someone pulling wings off a fly, or you know, tormenting a mouse. It's just you think the poor mouse, what a wicked man is doing this. But there you are, too good to waste. I used it, and as I say, this is in the David Copperfield comparison. Mr. Mike Carver is very similar to Dickens' father, and you don't. I mean, at one point, actually, Mr. Mike Carver becomes himself. You stop thinking about Dickens, you know, improvident father, and you just think about Mr. Mike Carver. So I hope at that point that will be the case with this. I mean, I don't know. But, of course, there are strong correspondences between this book and my family. But
For example,
my family.
Well, and your mother was the same age as she is when she died in the book. I mean, it's almost coincidental. Did she die before the book was published? I mean, did she?
No, after. No. I was still writing the book when my mother passed away. But also, you know, think about it. Here's a woman who was almost 104 years old and still sort of running the family. That's, again, too good to waste.
It is. So, well, and, you know.
I would say also that, you know, how many families do you know that have 7 or 8 children, and they're still, you know, functioning as a family. It's kind of an old-fashioned thing that my family even existed, because to a large extent, families have become much smaller, very intense, and the idea, the big family, is kind of an antique thing. And, you know, don't see them very often, particularly in the States. The idea of a big family kind of interests me, too. Also, people always talk about big, happy families. And I don't know any big, happy families. I just know big, unhappy families.
But that's you. I mean, all of your work is imbued with that type of Roald Dahl feeling that everybody's really pretty much, you know, a jackass at heart somewhere.
But I've never written about a big family before. I've never written about a tyrannical mother. This is all, it's all new, actually. It's all for me. And, you know, I published my first book 50 years ago, 1967. It was called Waldo. I was living in Africa at the time. And so I've been doing this thing for a long time. I've been in this business for a long time. So I've had a lot of time to think about my family and also a big novel. This is a big, ambitious, I hope it's a successful in artistic terms, but and, you know, in other terms too. But it's a book that I had longed to write. It's hard to write about a family. Usually that the first book that a writer writes is about his family, because the writer doesn't have any other experience except the experience of home life. So it's generally the first book. Thomas Mann's first book was Buddenbrooks. And, you know, name an American writer. Many of them were about their family, the first one. So, you know, that's The Catcher in the Rye is about a family. I waited to write this.
You waited a long time.
Yeah, 50 years.
But let's go back. What we're trying to do today is sell the book. So let's go back a little bit to the beginning, and, you know, because I kind of jumped in there with my suggestions. I want to go back to the beginning and describe what the book is actually about, because it's about a matriarch and an absent character who plays a very large part in the book as well.
I see it as a book, as I said, on one level, it's about a book about a guy who becomes a writer and how he becomes a writer. It's also a book about how late in life, family with the mother still hanging on there and getting older and older and older, and the children living among her, the family reconstitutes itself, and the children behave like little, bratty, greedy, quarreling children. They're like, I think of them as, you know, I was writing it, as big people, big sort of aged people in short pants, you know, and saying, that was mine, no, he hit me first, and all that. But they're all, you know, 50, 60, 70 years old, but they're behaving like children. And that's a conceit that amused me. And I thought, it's dark, it's weird, but the idea of the mother infantilizes the children, and the children behave badly, and then the mother rewards some and not others. So, I mean, I found the whole thing sort of funny.
Well, it's not funny, it's hilarious. And the funniest thing is, and it happens in my family too, and I'm kind of your contemporary. I'm 65, and my mom's 94, so it's just I'm 10 years shy of where you were. And you know, she might every once in a while she might look at me and say, twist her head, cock her head to the side, much like your mother might have, and say, I wonder why you never did anything with your life. And you know, it's like one of those things that just kind of goes down your spine. And then she might call my other brother, one of my two other brothers, and say, Sam was here the other night. He didn't seem himself. I wonder what's wrong with him. And you do a lot of those where everybody calls everybody. And some of those scenes are some of the most hilarious in the book, where somebody slights somebody in the most minor way, but the next day it's all around town and all the brothers and sisters know about it, and then it goes back and forth.
Well, I can see how you might relate to this, because that's exactly what it is, which is the mother playing one child off another and also saying these weird, insulting things.
They just pop out of nowhere.
You know, a parent might bite too, but if you've got any kind of, grip on your ego, you look at it, you take a step back and you say, you can be wounded by it. So you might take a step back and say, you know, that's kind of interesting. And you begin to see the person as a character, not your mother, not this person wounding you, but a case. You know, this woman is a case. This woman is like a fictional character. The whole thing is like fiction, and you deal with it that way. And that you try not to be hurt by it, because what's the point?
It's difficult.
And then if you're a writer, you see it as something else, the person as a character.
Oh well, that's a good question. Then, after 50 years, did this book seem to you to be in any way an act of therapy?
Maybe all writing is a way of, you know, dealing with the crises and difficulties of your life. I think that's true. I think that when you write about things, you begin to understand them. Certainly, writing this book about a family helped me understand my family a lot better. And I began to see the dynamics of it. I mean, for example, the eldest child in a family starts out as an only child. And so is very privileged and usually is the confidant of the parents. They become very successful or they become very dysfunctional. But either way, the world is theirs. Then another child comes along, and the eldest has to deal with that, and the younger one too. Then another one comes along, and another one. And pretty soon, you know, it's a nest of vipers. But the dynamics of it are such that each child has a different parent that or perceives the parent differently. And I mean, that's something that occurred to me. I think that the mother in this book is not someone that my siblings would recognize. And I say in the book that's the case. That's my mother, or that character's mother in the book. But each child has a different parent, because a parent is not, unless the parent is saint, and I suppose a lot of them are, but in general, the parent treats each child slightly different. And so every version of a family by a child or by the sibling is different. It's, you know, it's Rashomon, but, you know, with shifting levels of perception. So I'm sure that your brothers don't see your mother the same way that you do.
In some ways. But, it's, you know, the other thing is, you know, there are some parents...
Hey, Sam's criticizing Mom. He's very unfair. Like
That's true. And that does happen. But there are some parents who are like bodhisattvas who don't alter their personality because of the specific offspring. And there are some families. The American Families Association is not going to say that most large families grew up to be a nest of vipers. Only you would say that.
No, I don't say that they all do, but many do. But also, there's another dynamic going on in this book, which is the death of the father.
Yes.
Until the father dies, the family is kind of... In a very stable moment, and it's only when the father in the family passes away that the mother becomes triumphant, in charge, and reverts to some other condition of being tyrannical. And I think that that's also something that happens in families, that one parent passes away. The surviving parent kind of takes over. And then an odd thing happens. The parent may wonder, why are you for the dead parent, or are you loyal to me? You know, and so this is a loyalty element comes into it. It does in this family. And so this is really like a one-parent family. It's not like a whole coherent family with two parents.
And then you have
this is really the mother taking over.
And, you know, you have your father, and, you know, this has got to be a lot like your father because the Mr. Bones aspect of it. Why don't you talk a little bit about how the father in this book had two aspects of his personality, one in which he had that minstrel show thing going on where he was able to kind of let loose. You can explain it better than me, obviously.
I can explain it by saying that actually there was my father was in a minstrel show, and talking about liberties, there were big liberties taken in that chapter. But in the 1940s and 50s, there was such a thing in America as a minstrel show. I mean, actually, there were minstrels all over Europe too, with people singing songs in blackface. But it was a very odd thing that. In a minstrel show, white men and sometimes women would put on blackface and sing plantation songs. Now, this is really weird thing.
It was.
Even at the time when my father was in a minstrel show, about 1951, or early 50s. Could have been 49, I don't know. It was a long time ago. I thought it was strange. I thought it was embarrassing. Just my father singing was odd. Yeah. My father singing in blackface with a wig and a tambourine. I thought this is very odd. Later, in the 60s, civil rights movement kind of put an end to it. Actually, the whole issue of segregation from in the late 50s when race became an issue, minstrel shows faded. But while they were going, they were very odd. And I went to a very integrated school. I had a lot of black friends, and God knows what they thought of it. I never mentioned it to them, but it was very odd. Now, in the book, the liberties I took was, I saw this man, this father, as someone with a private life, someone who, in his quiet moments, was reflective and another person, a person that he didn't show at home. But when he put on his blackface, he became an angry black man. He became someone who teased, joked, prodded, and tyrannized to a certain extent while he was in blackface. Now, my father didn't do that, but I thought, as a conceit, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. I mean, I was very happy with the chapter. And actually, I remember after it appeared in the New Yorker, some African-Americans said to me, that was great. That was a great chapter. So they were really abused and kind of enlightened by it. Or at least they liked it.
Well, the material was excellent. I mean, the actual.
Yeah, yeah. But as I say, the germ of the idea of my father being in a minstrel show was definitely true. In fact, it was several years running. Horrendous and embarrassing for me because my father was exposed. But then I thought, I'm going to do something with this, and then I did it. So it's really about a man who uses his mask, being in blackface, to show a side of himself that he hadn't shown to his family before.
Well, if we continue to talk about it in terms of this bookending, no pun intended, liberties and conceits, talk a little bit about Angela, because in your own family you have a missing child who was mourned, and in this book, Angela, a little girl who dies close to birth, is revered by the mother, and a table like Elijah's, a chair like Elijah's, is set for her at birthday parties and things like that. How did that come about, and how did you bring that from your life to the book?
As a matter of fact, my mother did lose a child, and she mentioned the child every so often. But this, again, is a conceit, the idea that the dead child is the perfect child, sending it a place for it and all that. Oh, that's all fiction. It's a detail that I worked out. Whereas there's a line at the beginning of the book, there are eight of us and one of us was dead. Eight of us children and one of us was dead. And the idea of the dead child dominating the children is that's the book. That's not reality. But I extended it by the mother having this delusion that the child is still speaking to her. And then later in her life, at the end of her life, there's a caregiver, Mexican woman, who's called Angela. And my mother, in the book, begins to confuse the dead Angela with the live Angela. And then the narrator of the book falls in love with Angela. And they get it together. So... did that happen? No. I mean, I'm a happily married man. I'm now in Hawaii talking to you. I'm not in Mexico where the book ends. So you can see that's a novel. I think what happens in the early stages of a novel being published, people begin to relate it to the writer's life. When Lolita came out, people were asking Nabokov, "Do you like little girls?" And he said, "I rather dislike little girls." But they were identifying him as Humbert Humbert. And he had to answer all these questions. Now no one thinks about Nabokov. People just think about Lolita and Humbert and the girl. So I guess these questions of identifying the family in the book with my family are quite normal and to be expected. But as time goes on, my family will fade away, and I hope the book will endure.
I think the book will endure because it's, you know, and it's odd that I continue to call it hilarious, because in some ways it really shouldn't be looked at that way. You have a
No, if I may interrupt, it's a funny book.
Okay.
I was laughing when I was writing it. I sometimes pick it up, I read a line, and I laugh. So, no.
Well, that's what's so funny about you including your brother's diatribe, because it as you said, it's hilarious too, because it's so
hilarious. It's hilarious, the idea that my brother wrote this, published it, but it was 20 years ago that it appeared. It was in the late 90s, 96, 97, something like that. It's a long time ago. And it was just, I mean, I can't explain it. I've never really had a good explanation from him. It's not a subject that we discuss. We talk about other things. We talk about books. We talk about Joseph Conrad, Ford Madox Ford. You know, we talk about Hamlet. We don't talk about this piece in Boston Magazine. But when you read it, and I didn't change a word, actually. I left a lot out. What I put in the book, what I quoted, is only about, you know, 20 or 30% of it. For legal reasons, I can only quote fair use. I can only use, because if I don't, I could be sued by him.
That would be perfect full circle if he sued you.
Yeah, it would be, but unfortunately, that's not the case. But, yeah, as I say, it's too good to waste. The idea of a woman becoming, you know, 102, 103, and still with a grip of steel on a family, as you know, my mother was that old. Just people getting old. I mean, I was aware of my mother when, you know, she was a much younger woman, just this trajectory of her getting old, too good to waste.
So, well, there's several things, like the idea that, and my mom does the same thing, is, you know, you ask her how she's doing, no complaints. The exact words your mom or that mom or Jay's mom says, no complaints. And the idea that she's not taking anything in terms of medication, which she, you know, loves to talk about. Everybody in Jay's family is on some type of medication, to whether it's beta blockers or high blood pressure medicine, and Anne is not on anything at all.
Well, when you're talking about medicine, you're also in this area of really funny names.
Yeah, I know.
Funny names of medicine. So now some of that is just bluffs. It's just, you know, and then even the things like, you know, irritable bowel syndrome, opioid induced constipation. You know, all of the weird, what is it, restless leg. He's got restless leg. So, I mean, it's sad if you have these ailments, but talking about medicine, it's like talking about, you know, some Amazonian tribe talking about their, you know, magic potions.
Yeah, well, so, and Floyd, you use Floyd as your, you know, your comedian, especially like an Upside Down Cake. You know, he makes fun of all of these ailments, and he makes fun of all the drugs and the different, you know.
Yeah, Floyd has the last word on most things. He's a funny guy. He's funny. I mean, I could say that my brother is funny. Not as funny as Floyd. Because Floyd is funny. I mean, I made Floyd funny. But there you are. I mean, it's a big book. It's a complicated book, but it really is about this family, and it's about people finding their destinies within the family.
Yeah, at first, when I looked at it and realized the size of it, I thought, well, you know, to be honest, I thought, well, am I going to get bored through this? And it never, ever, I was never bored in the slightest for a moment. And even though a lot of the situations repeated themselves in terms of the feelings that the brothers and sisters had for each other or for their mom or for Jay's children, there was never a boring moment in the book. And it's strange when I look back on it in hindsight that you were able to carry it on as long as you did. And I would have been able to read another 500 pages and still not be bored. But...
Well, that's nice to hear. Thank you very much. I actually, it was a much longer book. It was 25,000 words longer.
Wow.
And I cut it because I felt there were some scenes that didn't work. There was repetitions. But yeah, I cut it considerably. I think it, I wrote a book that's longer than this called Ozone. I wrote it in the around 80.
Oh, yeah.
Published in 87, 88, something like that. But way back in the late 80s, that was probably a bit longer. But it's a very challenging thing to write a long book. a year goes by and you're still working on it, and another year goes by and you're still working on it. People say, how's it going? You say, coming along. But in the meantime, I was publishing other things, so I wasn't hard pressed. But it really is a mission, to deal with a manuscript that big. It's just a physical problem. Even when it's a stack of paper, it's a problem. It's a physical effort of going through it. But I'm not the only person that's had to deal with it. I mean, other people have written long books.
It's interesting how, Jay, to get away, he gets away. And to leave Cape Cod, he goes on a year-long or a two-year-long trip to the, to odd places that other people tourists are not going to go to. And he goes to places that are dangerous at times, just like you have in your life, your entire life. And then it seems like the chore, the difficult thing, the dangerous thing, the dangerous thing is coming home. The dangerous thing for Jay is coming home to be with his family.
Yeah, that's true. That's well said. I mean, and accurately reported that the main character goes to Uganda, has a pretty good time, goes from Cairo to Cape Town, overland, has a reasonably interesting time, goes to New Guinea, goes up to the Amazon and whatever. And then comes home, and his family's driving him absolutely insane. And actually, there's a moment where it's a chapter called Pastoral, where he's in Mexico, and he's sort of on the footsteps of B. Traven, the man who wrote The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. And he's having a great time in Mexico. And then when he's really at peace, he gets a telegram saying, a text message, come home, mother's ill. And oh, God. So he leaves the wilds of Chiapas and then goes to Cape Cod and is driven mad. The mother claims not to be sick at all. But, yeah, that's an irony and a contradiction. I won't say that's true in my life. I mean, I've found some of the trips I've taken I've found to be very, very difficult. But anyway, this guy's family is like a tribe, living in the jungle. That image is used a lot, of the family like a tribe in a jungle clearing. And then he says, I've been to a lot of jungle clearings and I never found anyone, any group as difficult as my family. I don't know whether that's true in my case, but it was a way of using my travel and some of my experiences too.
Yeah, not to give anything away, but the last line, the very last line of the book, kind of gives Jay the solace that he was looking for, in some fashion. But what about in one of the interviews on I guess with regard to Upside Down Cake, is when you inserted Charlie, your son, Jay is the birth father of. But you also find yourself in a parallel situation. The question was, why did Jay bring Charlie to the party, and was it an act of, not of anger or retribution for his family? And you insert Charlie and Jay's two other sons in there. They seem to be great people. And it's funny because when I'm reading it, I'm thinking everybody old is either fat, balding, miserable, mean-spirited, and these younger kids, Jay's sons, are all like angels. They're good, solid, salt-of-the-earth people who express concern and understanding.
And yeah, that's true. True of the book. To a certain extent, it's true of my life that I consider my children to be very well-adjusted and well-educated and fulfilled. My son, Louis, has a hit TV show in England.
Yep.
Just made a movie about Scientology. It's called My Scientology Movie. It was very successful. Marcel is a highly regarded novelist. He's published five novels. his sixth is coming out in September. So, yeah, I think my children seem happy and fulfilled. They have children. I have grandchildren. So, but you notice they don't live.
No. Yeah.
Me. They're not. I mean, I'm not tyrannizing them and driving them nuts. I think there are significant differences between, as I said, my family and this family. But that the generation, the next generation, my children, and you know, actually, so there are some children in this family in the book who are really difficult.
Benno.
They're sort of funny. They're funny too.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a book about a mother. It's a book about a family, but it's about a mother dominating the family. So it's all these elements are there, but I wanted it to hang together. When you write a novel, you actually have to not only take liberties, but you're creating something that's a coherent, unified whole. There can't be a lot of loose ends in a book this big. It needs a superstructure, an internal logic. You don't find that logic always, or sometimes ever, in a big family. So, I mean, when we write, we're creating something. We're not recreating a family. We're actually making a construction, which has a design in it. But you could say, I suppose, in your family, but most people's families, where's the design? Where's the, you know, where's the superstructure of this? Where's the internal logic? Most of them are just, you know, kind of instances of entropy, of things just flying apart.
That's true.
That's not the case of a novel.
No, but you know what? It's like what you were saying about how you, Jay, became a writer because of your family, and perhaps your children became writers because of you in a different, more wholesome way, in my opinion. But in any event, the thing about Motherland is that, yes, there's a construct and there's an arrangement and there's motion and there's the passage of an enormous amount of time, but, and I think you do this on purpose, and I think you explicated it earlier, the family is treading water, and it's like saying, you know, you're not an orphan. You're never an orphan until your last parent dies. And these grown-ups in short pants are treading water, waiting for something. And like John Lennon said, you know, life is what happens when you're busy planning other things.
That's true. And you could fairly say, what do these people want?
Yeah, what do they want? What do they want?
Well, they want to torment each other. and they're happiest, most content, most fulfilled, when they're driving each other nuts. And when things are kind of going well, they're really not happy. But and the mother is that way, too. The mother really isn't content unless she's driving everyone nuts or in control, setting one against another. I could say most dictatorships are like that. And I compare this book to a dictatorship. Comparison is the mother in the book, kind of without ever reading a book of political science or knowing much about a revolution, becomes like Stalin, Chairman Mao, Pol Pot. You know, she's sort of recapitulating the lives of a dictator, and you know that's kind of an interesting thing to me. But I would say that in my own family, people have done interesting things. I mean, it's not that's another kind of significant difference. But in this family, this is, you know, nest of vipers, crabs in a basket. It's just people clawing at each other. And I suppose one of the motivating factors is the mother handing out money. I mean, that's a big thing in the book. It's the favoritism in the book.
And that part, too. The burglarizing of her house was hilarious by Floyd and Jay.
Actually, that's part that makes me laugh, and I'm glad you find it hilarious.
No, it really was. And then, but unfortunately, Paul, then I thought to myself, I wonder if Paul ever did this.
No, that would be a crime. That would be bad. That would be a crime. But the idea of, you know, who would do that? A 13-year-old would do it.
Right, exactly.
Not a guy in his 60s, but the idea of, you know, Freud defines happiness as a childhood fantasy fulfilled in adulthood. It's, you know, something you always wanted to do as a child.
The other reason...
I'm going to have to go pretty soon, Sam.
Okay, that's fine.
But do you have any last thoughts or last questions?
No last thoughts or questions, but one comment is I do have an independent bookstore here in Pennsylvania. If you're ever back this way again, I'd love to have you come by. But right now, your book is in the front window. It's on the front table. It's a wonderful book. I think it'll do very well. And, you know, it's been an honor for me to talk to you after following your career for, as you said, some 50 years. So thank you so much for being here.
Okay, Sam. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. We were speaking with Paul Theroux, author of Motherland and thousands of other things, 30 novels, 20 travel books, movies, The Mosquito Coast with Harrison Ford, all kinds of things. A very famous man with a famous family, and a book that interweaves his life with this fictional life of an enormous family that he calls a nest of vipers. And I can't overemphasize the fact that it's not his family, because he said it over and over again. And although there are parallels, as he said, and the way he writes is not autobiography, but it's his life with taking liberties. So in any event, I thoroughly enjoyed speaking with him. It's an honor to talk to him, because I very seldom get a chance to talk to someone who's been my hero for some 30 years and whose books are so amazing. And I have the honor of talking to a bunch of other people coming up as well. This guy, Matt James, who wrote this book called Collecting Evolution, The Galapagos Expedition that Vindicated Darwin, talks about the 1905-1906 ship, the Academy, that went to the Galapagos and collected all kinds of specimens in order to vindicate Darwin's theories, turn them into facts. Linda Mapes is also going to be with us talking about her book Witness Tree, which is another nonfiction book, also biologically based, about a tree. Seasons of Change with a Century-Old Oak. So it talks about the macro and the micro life of a 100-year-old oak tree, and gets to evolution from the size of flora rather than fauna. So I'm looking forward to that one as well. And we have a whole load of people that are coming along that will take us through the mid part of the year. And in any event, as I said, I really enjoyed talking with Paul Theroux. It was indeed an honor. So thanks so much for stopping by today, and we look forward to seeing you back here next week for another edition of The Avid Reader.